From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, U.S. withholds judgment of China oil rigs. Afghan refugees reluctant to return. Thai police general offers cash for photos of dissidents. These stories and more in this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The United States says it will withhold judgment for now on the intended destination of four new Chinese oil rigs in the disputed South China Sea. Daybreak Asia's Victor Beatty reports it appears Beijing is stepping up its exploration for oil and gas 2 months after positioning a giant drilling platform in waters also claimed by Vietnam.
China announced Friday it will send another four oil rigs to the South China Sea. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said they will operate off the coast of China's Guangdong and Hainan provinces, referring to them as normal activities, adding there is no need to read too much into them. Last month, China set off a bilateral dispute with neighbor Vietnam by positioning an oil rig off the Paracel Islands within Vietnam's exclusive economic zone. That sparked bilateral tensions, including anti-China rioting in Vietnam and confrontations between Chinese and Vietnamese vessels near the oil rig. High-level talks in Vietnam last week failed to resolve the dispute. Friday, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jennifer Psaki said Washington is aware of reports China is towing additional oil rigs to different locations in the South China Sea.
I think there's not a great deal of information at this point as to where they're headed. If a rig were placed in disputed waters, that would be a concern. And we certainly have a national interest in the maintenance of peace and stability in the region. So at this point, we don't have enough information about the intended destinations of these rigs, so we'll hold back judgment until we know more.
The United States criticized the placement of the first oil rig in early May off the Paracels as provocative and destabilizing. China, which has competing territorial claims in the South China Sea with Vietnam, Taiwan, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei, claims most of the waters as its inherent historical territory. Carl Thayer, Professor Emeritus at Australia's University of New South Wales, who just returned from a meeting on South China Sea disputes in Vietnam, says the more rigs China puts in place, the more difficult it will be for Hanoi to monitor them.
One, two, three, four rigs would stretch Vietnamese civilian paramilitary and fishery surveillance forces to the limit. Vietnam just doesn't have an awful lot of ships. I think there's a total of 40 in the Coast Guard, and they're one half the size and weight of the Chinese vessels, at least. So it would be an unequal contest if Vietnam tried to adopt the same tactics of protesting.
Thayer says China has already indicated the disputed oil rig off the Paracels is a commercial exploration unit and will only operate between May 2nd and August 15th, in part due to the onset of the typhoon season.
But also by limiting the operations of the oil rig, then they have a way of bowing out, if you will, gracefully, or face saving. They can just say the commercial activities are over and the rig will be removed.
Thayer says after August 15th, it might be possible for a high-level Vietnamese delegation to go to Beijing in a bid to improve relations. In any event, he says energy industry executives have told him the location of the Chinese oil rig is not an ideal place to go to first in search of gas. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
A South Korean army sergeant accused of killing five fellow soldiers is expected to survive a self-inflicted gunshot wound received before his capture Monday. The 22-year-old, identified only by the last name of Lim, hid in a forest after a rifle and grenade attack Saturday that killed five soldiers and wounded seven at an outpost near the demilitarized zone bordering North Korea. South Korean troops cornered the soldier in Gosun, about 220 kilometers northeast of Seoul, on Sunday afternoon. Lim shot himself in the chest with an assault rifle as family members approached, asking him to surrender. He was hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries, a defense ministry official told the Associated Press. A memorial for the dead soldiers has been set up. A Tokyo City lawmaker has come forward as one of the politicians who heckled a female colleague during a city council meeting last week. Akahiro Suzuki of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party publicly and privately apologized Monday to opposition party member Ayaka Shiomura for shouting, "Hurry up and get married," as she spoke in support of mothers at a meeting of the Tokyo Metropolitan Assembly. During a press conference Monday, Suzuki called his remark inconsiderate. He added that while he has resigned from his party, he will remain an assemblyman. He was one of several sexist remarks allegedly made against Shimura during the meeting. However, Suzuki is the first to have acknowledged his participation. The incident comes as Japan's government prepares to announce economic reforms aimed at increasing the number of women in management and expanding daycare services to support working parents. Tens of thousands of Afghans remain in Pakistan, having fled decades of conflict and persecution at home. The governments of both countries, together with the help of the United Nations, have recently stepped up efforts to repatriate the refugees. But political uncertainties about Afghanistan's presidential elections have fueled long-term security and economic worries among these Afghans, and many of them are now increasingly reluctant to move. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
This is an informal refugee settlement on the outskirts of the Pakistani capital, where more than 450 families from different parts of Afghanistan are living under extremely difficult conditions. They face economic hardships, health setbacks, and a lack of education. Maya Amritunga is officer in charge of UNHCR in Pakistan.
The refugees have been here for a long time. Many of them have been here for 30 years. Many of them have been born in Pakistan.
Amritunga says the UNHCR has been successfully running its voluntary repatriation program for Afghan refugees since 2002, but says the remaining population is now increasingly reluctant to go back.
So far, 3.8 million Afghans from Pakistan have already repatriated, including many people from here. So that same option is available to this refugee population. But I can understand that they want to wait until after the elections. They want to wait until after the international troops withdraw from Afghanistan. And they want to see that there will be peace and stability in Afghanistan before they decide to go back.
Shah Jamroz Khan, a long-time Afghan refugee, says his country has seen a lot of positive changes and development since his family became refugees in Pakistan. But he complains the Kabul government has paid almost no attention to the resettlement of Afghans, and he's not very optimistic about the new political administration.
Whatever they do will only be known when they practically demonstrate it to benefit Afghans returning to their country. If the refugees end up confronting the same hardships that they are facing in Pakistan, they would prefer not to go back to Afghanistan.
Speaking at a ceremony in Islamabad, Afghan ambassador to Pakistan, Janan Musazai, reiterated Kabul's appreciation for Pakistan's long-running hospitality and generosity to millions of Afghans.
But it's time for us to go back. To go back to Afghanistan and to take part in the reconstruction and development of the new Afghanistan that has emerged over the past 13 years.
Pakistan has recently agreed to allow Afghan refugees to stay in the country until the end of 2015, citing its own economic and security challenges. But aid workers see Afghanistan's political turmoil as a major setback to efforts aimed at persuading the 1.6 million registered refugees currently in Pakistan to return. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
There is some great video with Ayaz Ghul's story. If you have access to the internet, you can see it on our website at voanews.com. A prominent Pakistani cleric who lives in Canada arrived in Lahore Monday after his plane was diverted from Islamabad following clashes between his supporters and police at Islamabad's airport. Tahir ul-Qadri returned to Pakistan to lead a self-proclaimed revolution against Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Security was tight Monday ahead of Qadri's planned arrival in Islamabad. Qadri, a religiously moderate cleric, has a large following in Pakistan. Some analysts believe he is also supported by the country's powerful military establishment as a way to keep civilian authorities in check. India's government has announced measures to control rising food prices. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the government came to power last month on promises of reining in inflation, but a spike in food and fuel prices poses a challenge.
As inflation in the month of May climbed to 6%, the government promised immediate action to keep a lid on food prices. Finance Minister Arun Jaitley says the government will impose restrictions on hoarding, the export of some items, and will track prices of essential commodities.
Minimum export price in relation to potatoes will be fixed Also, with regard to onions, additional quantities of rice will be released into the market. Even though the increase has only been marginal, we don't want anybody to exploit the situation. And therefore, in anticipation of any further market reaction, a series of these steps have been decided.
To discourage exports of onions, the government has doubled the minimum export price to $300 per ton. Onions, used as the base for Indian curries, are a hugely politically sensitive crop in India, and rising prices usually trigger massive public anger. An increase in food prices was a major reason for the downfall of the former Congress-led government. That is why inflation, which is at a five-month high, is worrying the new Bharatiya Janata Party government, which has made controlling food prices and reviving the economy its top priority. There are fears prices could continue to climb because of forecasts that weak monsoon rains may hit crop production in the country of 1.2 billion people. The government is also gearing for a shortfall in production of summer crops such as rice and cotton. But economist D.H. Pai Panandikar with RPG Goenka Foundation in New Delhi says it may be hard to control prices of vegetables and fruits, but the government has ample stocks of rice and wheat, the country's staple diet.
I think government has enough stocks of food grains. That is one advantage government has. But these must be used right in time in order to check any rise in prices. The more effective measures are really stopping exports, importing wherever necessary, whatever you can import. And third thing is the release of stocks in time in the market.
The government, which came to the helm 3 weeks ago, faces a tough challenge in the coming months as it tries to revive economic growth that has fallen below 5%. Besides food prices, rising global oil prices due to the crisis in Iraq have added to the woes of a country that imports most of its oil. The higher oil prices could add a crippling $3 billion to the government's bill for subsidizing fuels such as kerosene and diesel. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
A Bangladesh court has sentenced to death 8 members of an outlawed Islamist militant group for a bombing that targeted a New Year's celebration, killing 10 people and wounding dozens more. 6 people were sentenced to life in prison Monday for the bombing in Dhaka in 2001. The group had deemed the New Year's celebrations un-Islamic. Thailand's police force is now asking for citizens' help in identifying those perceived to be displaying opposition to the military coup in the kingdom. We have details from VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok.
A Thai police general has announced he will give cash rewards to those turning in photos or videos of anyone illegally expressing a political stance. Political gatherings of more than 5 people and comments, including those posted on social media expressing opinions that could incite unrest, are banned under martial law. Authorities have been detaining students and others who, in public, have engaged in seemingly mundane activities, such as eating sandwiches, wearing T-shirts with slogans, reading the George Orwell novel 1984, or making a 3-fingered gesture popularized in the movie The Hunger Games. Deputy Police Commissioner Somyat Pumpanmong has announced rewards of about $15 for each picture of such suspects. The police general said he will personally pay the reward for any photographs that result in charges. A longtime observer of Thai history and politics, Tyrell Habercorn, a fellow in political and social change at the Australian National University, calls this dismaying. She terms it an assault on human expression going beyond the political realm.
The line of what's considered criminal is shifting with every day, but also marks an incredibly concerning move because it's, in a sense, a request for citizens to become vigilantes.
Under martial law, the military has the right to try those arrested, and the decisions of the military courts will be final, according to the junta. Habercorn says the international community should be paying close attention to the alarming developments affecting Thailand's judiciary.
that there's no appeal in the military court is very, very concerning, given what seems to be the ease with which peaceful activists have been charged with very grave crimes against the Crown and state. I'm most concerned about what's going to happen if and when those proceedings begin.
Such organizations as the Asian Human Rights Commission, for which Habercorn is an advisor, and Amnesty International have condemned the junta's scrapping of civil courts as illegal under international human rights law. A military court Monday approved arrest warrants for 28 people, including a former cabinet minister and dissident exile Jakrapub Penkar. There could be more arrests Tuesday. Police General Somyot says his officers are prepared to deal with possible protests that might occur in Bangkok to mark the anniversary of the June 24, 1932 Siamese Revolution. That coup ended the era of absolute monarchy and resulted in the kingdom's first constitution. Thailand has no constitution. It was abrogated by General Prayut Chan-o-cha, the army chief, who has assumed all executive and legislative powers since carrying out the May 22nd coup. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Fortune tellers in Thailand have had long been sought for spiritual advice and guidance. But in military-ruled Thailand, which is steeped in a political crisis, even spiritual ceremonies can take on political overtones. Steve Sanford reports from Chiang Mai, Thailand.
As Thailand faces uncertain times, many are seeking guidance from spiritualists and fortune tellers. Popular Thai soothsayer Warin Buwawilaler says he got his calling early in life.
When I was 9 years old, my spirit traveled outside my body and I could see myself through a vision. Since then, I have studied the supernatural until now.
More than 40 years later, the clairvoyant offers his predictions to Thailand's affluent, including the country's top brass. Following the 2006 coup, Warin performed a special life-prolonging ceremony for the generals, and he claims he has visions of Thailand's current military ruler.
In a vision, I saw General Prayut was a great soldier for King Narasimhan, and I was involved with him too. I saw the vision from the past life when we fought together, and now we are born again in this life to save the country.
But many in the northern voting strongholds of ousted leader Yingluck Shinawat see little to be happy about, including this group attending a local spirit festival to honor their ancestors who protect the village. A deeply flawed populist rice subsidy scheme has been scrapped, leaving growers worried that profits will go elsewhere.
In the past year, the rice scheme benefited the farmers. If there's no pledging project, the middleman will push the price lower, and only they will keep the money in their pockets.
The army remains tight-lipped about future policies, and village chiefs must report any suspicious activities.
We put up a red flag to mark where our spirit ceremony was. The soldiers came to our festival asking us if we were involved with red shirt political activists.
For now, the military has managed to silence the critics, but many Thai academics predict the country could unravel quickly if voices from the rural majority are ignored. Steve Sanford reporting for VOA from Chiang Mai, Thailand.
Malaysia's highest court has upheld a government ban against a Roman Catholic newspaper using the word Allah to refer to God. The federal court ruled in a 4-3 decision Monday that the church's Malay language newspaper, The Herald, had no grounds to appeal a lower court decision last year that Allah should be reserved exclusively for Muslims because if other religions use the word, it could be confusing and lead Muslims to convert. Such conversion is illegal in Malaysia, where more than 60% of the population of 30 million are Muslim, the country's official religion. Just over 9% are Christian. Today's Women Rising segment focuses on the practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM. Daha Dukera is a 24-year-old survivor of FGM. In June, she joined U.S. Representatives Joseph Crowley and Sheila Jackson Lee, along with Shelby Quast, a senior policy advisor for the group Equality Now, to discuss their efforts to end female genital mutilation in the United States. The group is asking the Obama administration to commission the first study of FGM in the United States since 1997. Shelby Quast tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso that American teenagers are experiencing FGM in this country or taken out of the country for so-called vacation cutting.
There was a congressional letter that was signed by 58 bipartisan members of Congress calling on the U.S. administration to address FGM, to implement the law that was passed in 2013 that closed the gap that allowed girls to be taken outside the country for purposes of FGM, called vacation cutting. And that was sent to members of Department of Education, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Justice, and the White House to address FGM and put this plan together and really actively do something to end FGM in the U.S.
I think what is most shocking is that FGM happens in the United States.
It happens in the United States, where we're hearing that there are girls who are being subjected to FGM who have not left the country, but also to young girls who live here, but who's taken to their parents' home country for the summer, and they come home very changed.
How does this come to light when they get back? I mean, how is this a prosecutable crime if this is just not something talked about, and more than likely these young ladies don't have a regular gynecological exam?
That was part of the discussions that we were having with these different departments, and that is that frontline professionals not only need to be aware of what's going on, but that they need to know how to respond once they do become aware. So it could be schools, it could be school counselors, it could be school nurses. It's somewhat clear that something has happened, and a lot of times these girls are aware that that's going to happen. When children are applying for visas, especially going back to these particular countries that still practice this, the Department of Justice is working with these embassies to say, when someone that age applies for a visa, we need you to inform them that it's against the law for them to take that child to get FGM. But also making the embassies in those countries aware. If a girl is aware this is going to happen and is seeking help, that she can say that, or there's a hotline that she can call. So not just law enforcement. That's one piece of it. But how do we start raising awareness about the law, about the practice, about the rights of girls?
So this is more of a community policing.
That's part of it as well. It has to happen within the community. We have to have the discussion. Most people don't know there's a law against this in the United States, or even candidly what FGM is. So many of those frontline professionals who are really engaging with girls and with families and with these communities, that they need to be better informed.
Now, this doesn't only happen in African countries. This just happened in Asia, correct?
Yes. You know, Indonesia is one of the a very large prevalence country. One of the areas that has been of concern to Equality Now is the prevalence to want to medicalize FGM, and in some way try to make that legitimate. And really what the call is at the UN and what we're trying to say is that any type of FGM is a human rights abuse. And so we want to make sure that there are no laws in place that are protecting FGM and legitimizing it.
You mean medicalized, meaning there are actual physical doctors performing this cutting?
Yes, and that in Indonesia, where the law says if it's performed by a medical doctor, then it's legal. And we've obviously, that's incredibly problematic, and we're trying to see that they really look at that law, look at what the international standards are calling for, and that they reverse it. For Equality Now, it is really looking at those issues in that bigger picture, and FGM is often done to prove virginity because it raises the value for early marriage. So when we start to really step back, I think that we do have to step up. We have to lead the way. And maybe previously, when it was believed that these things weren't happening to U.S. citizens, that there might have been some people saying, then it's not our problem. But it is happening here, and it is happening to U.S. citizens. And we can't always put adolescent girls at the bottom of the priority list. And I think we need to be very careful about that.
Shelby Quast, Senior Policy Advisor for Equality Now, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Frances Alonzo, who joins us each Tuesday with her Women Rising series. Steve Norman joins us virtually every day for the latest world news. You don't have to set an alarm clock for it. Just stay tuned. He's next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News.